listening to a speech given by journalist Elizabeth Colbert, given on April 16, 2006, and sponsored by WGBH in Boston. You can find this and many other fine speeches at forum.wgbh.org. Part one of two.
We are very excited about tonight's talk by Elizabeth Colbert, who at one point worked for the New York Times as a political writer, but I first encountered Elizabeth's writing, as I'm sure many of you did, in The New Yorker, where she still writes for The New Yorker. Elizabeth lives with her family out in Williamstown, again, we are delighted to have her with us tonight. Elizabeth has agreed to take some questions at the end of her talk, and I hope there will be some. I'm sure there will be. So without further delay, I've got to back up a bit, because usually I give the housekeeping stuff, and I forgot that. But the housekeeping stuff is simply this, that in the case of an emergency, there are two approved fire exits, one through this doorway, the exit sign, and one behind you, and diagonally across the back, out through the corridor into the building next door. And the only other housekeeping matter I would like to take up with you is that if any of you have cell phones or pagers, could you please turn them off out of consideration for our speaker tonight? Having finished with that, without further delay, it gives me great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Elizabeth Colbert. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks for that very kind introduction. And I will just say I've never been to the Boston Athenaeum before, but it's a beautiful spot. So it's a really pleasure to be here. I'm just going to start by saying tonight that although I am going to be talking about the science of global warming, as you all know, I'm sure, I'm not really an expert on this subject. I don't have the training of an atmospheric chemist or geophysicist or climate modeler or any of the other disciplines in which climate scientists are trained. But I'm here because I do what scientists actually usually don't do, which is to tell stories. And beginning almost exactly 2 years ago, in about March of 2004, I set out to write about global warming for The New Yorker. And this meant initially just talking to a lot of people. I talked to a lot of scientists, and also I spoke to Native Alaskans, and to a lot of politicians, and to archaeologists, and eventually to people in New Orleans whose houses had filled with 10 feet of water during Hurricane Katrina. And in the process, I got to travel to some extraordinary places like the Greenland Ice Sheet, which you see up here behind me. And finally, I tried to pull together what I had seen and heard into a series of articles that people waiting in their dentist's office to have their teeth cleaned or commuting home to Brooklyn on the IRT might want to read. And if that sounds like a crazy enterprise, then I have to confess it often felt like a crazy enterprise. Now, except when things go pretty awfully wrong, the mechanics of journalism are not, even to reporters, really that terribly interesting. So I'm not going to talk tonight very much about what went into writing these stories, except to say that I think that global warming is a very difficult issue for journalists to deal with. And if you look at the front page of today's paper, and this could be the New York Times or it could be the Boston Herald, you tend to find two kinds of stories. And the first is a simple news story. Yesterday, scientists announced that they had found a fossil of a fish who had, you know, the beginnings of limbs, or Meryl Streep showed up in town to pick up a lovely award. And the second is a controversy. The House and Senate are deadlocked over immigration legislation, or should the Boston Police Department be giving free training to the cops at private universities? But global warming is not a news event, and it is not a controversy, although often, because of the norms of journalism, it gets presented as such. It is, rather, an inexorable process that we have set in motion. And where exactly this process is going to take us is, at this point, impossible to say. in part because it's impossible to know how we as a society will respond to it. And so far, in spite of really everything that has been learned, we haven't done much in response, and this is especially true here in the U.S., where one could argue that on a national level, at least, we really haven't done anything at all. And in the course of my research, I came to see global warming as an example of both the extraordinary power of science and also as an example of its impotence. And this is, in its own way, as I'm sure you know, also a classic narrative pattern, not so much for journalism as for tragedy. And such is our scientific and technological mastery. We now have at our disposal satellite measurements, general circulation models, supercomputers, and detailed ice core records going back 650,000 years. So to a remarkable degree, we can now look into the future and know where we are headed. And yet we refuse to see. And it is this tragic combination of blindness and insight that I want to talk about tonight. Now, as an idea, global warming is, at this point, more than a century old already. And the initial critical insight dates all the way back to the middle of the 19th century to the work of an Irish physicist named John Tyndall. And Tyndall built a machine, the world's first ratio spectrophotometer, which you can see up there. This is from an 1861 engraving, in fact, because he wanted to measure the way that different gases absorb and transmit radiation. And when Tyndall tested the most common gases in our atmosphere, which are nitrogen and oxygen, he found that they were fully transparent, which is to say that they allowed both visible and infrared radiation to pass in and out freely. But other gases were not. CO2 and, just as significantly, water vapor were, he discovered, transparent in the visible part of the spectrum, but partly opaque in the infrared. Now, climate was a 19th century preoccupation, even, you could say, an obsession. Louis Agassiz published his theory of the ice ages in 1840. I'm sure his book is in this library somewhere. And it was a great sensation. "Your work on glaciers has filled me with admiration," Charles Darwin wrote to him. But what could have caused the advance and retreat of the ice sheets? Tyndall saw that his discovery had hugely important implications in this regard. Those selectively transparent gases, he theorized, determined the planet's temperature. And Tyndall was a tremendously popular lecturer, and a lot of his lectures were collected and sold as collections. There are probably some volumes here. And this is a real testament to the intellectual interests of the Victorian middle class. And he's a wonderful writer. I actually commend his lectures to you. And he wrote, in his flowery Victorian style, he likened the impact of these selectively transparent gases to that of a dam built across a river. "Just as a dam causes a local deepening of the stream, so our atmosphere, thrown as a barrier against the terrestrial rays, produces a local heightening of the temperature at the Earth's surface." Now, the phenomenon that Tyndall identified is what is today referred to as the natural greenhouse effect. And this is a schematic diagram of how the natural greenhouse effect works. And I'm sure many of you have seen similar diagrams. And the natural greenhouse is not, and really since Tyndall's day, hasn't been controversial. It's described in any basic earth science textbook because, as Tyndall recognized all the way back in the 1860s, it is crucial to life on Earth as we know it. And typically, the natural greenhouse effect is explained in terms of a thought experiment, which I'm sure that many of you are familiar with. The Earth is constantly getting in radiation from the sun. In this diagram, it's the blue lines, and it's constantly giving radiation back out to space, mostly in the form of infrared radiation. And in order for the planet to be in equilibrium, which is to say neither heating up nor cooling down, then the energy coming in and the energy going out have to be equivalent. And now imagine a world without greenhouse gases. In that case, it is comparatively easy, using a law known as the Stefan-Boltzmann law, which states that the radiation emitted by a body is proportional to its temperature raised to the fourth power, to calculate how warm the planet would have to be to radiate out the same amount of energy it receives from the sun. And I'm not going to do this math. I'm not sure I could do this math, but those who have done this math tell us that it turns out to be 0 degrees Fahrenheit. And here I'm talking about average global temperatures. And that's about 40 degrees colder than it was at the depth of the last ice age. So at 0 degrees, the planet would be, if not necessarily lifeless, then I think we can all agree, a very, very uncomfortable place. To draw on Tyndall's Victorian language once again, if the heat-trapping gases were removed from the Earth's atmosphere for a single day, the warmth of our fields and gardens would pour itself unrequited into space, and the sun would rise upon an island, he was British, of course, held fast in the iron grip of frost. Now, at the time that Tyndall was doing his experiments in the late 1850s and early 1860s, industrialization was, of course, already in full swing. Henry Bessemer had just invented the Bessemer process for mass-producing steel. The Central Pacific and Union Pacific Railroads were working their way toward their eventual union in Promontory Summit, Utah, and the world's first petroleum refinery was about to be built in Titusville, Pennsylvania. And Tyndall certainly understood that burning fossil fuels produce CO2. But while he speculated about the effects of changing greenhouse gas levels on climate history, such changes, he wrote, would have been capable of producing all of the mutations of climate which the researches of geologists reveal, he never, as far as we know, went so far as to consider how these changes might affect the climate future. And that next step was taken by a Swedish chemist named Svante Arrhenius. And Arrhenius took Tyndall's argument, and he tried to test it in a rigorous way. He tried to ask, what is the quantitative relationship between greenhouse gas levels and temperatures here on Earth? And he was mainly interested in, as had Tyndall been, in trying to figure out what had caused the ice ages. But he asked what would happen to the Earth's temperature if CO2 levels were halved, and also if they were doubled. And these questions turn out to be easy to ask, but quite difficult to answer, because if you change the CO2 level in the atmosphere, then you are also changing a lot of other things, including how much moisture the air can hold, and since water vapor is also a greenhouse gas, you get a lot of these sort of feedback effects. And Arrhenius would eventually win the Nobel Prize for an unrelated discovery, his theory of electrolytic dissociation. But he described his calculations on CO2 as some of the most difficult he ever did in his life. And he began them on, supposedly, so the story goes, on Christmas Eve, 1894. His wife had just left him, I should mention that too. And he routinely worked on them for 14 hours a day. And it took him nearly a year to finish. And these calculations are actually still extant. Somewhere in Sweden you can visit them if you'd like. And drawing the connection that Tyndall had failed to make, Arrhenius predicted that industrialization would inevitably lead to higher global temperatures. So this is a prediction made back in the 1890s. And indeed, the warming that he predicted as a result of his year of calculation for doubled CO2 levels turns out to be eerily close to that which is now predicted by the most sophisticated computer models, which take about a month to run on a set of supercomputers. Arrhenius' estimate was that if you doubled CO2, you would get an average global temperature increase of between 9 and 11 degrees Fahrenheit, and current estimates are about between 3.5 and 7 degrees Fahrenheit. But Arrhenius also missed what now seems to us to be the really significance of his own findings. And there's a couple reasons for that, and one of which is that he was a chemist and not a biologist or a geologist, and he doesn't seem to have appreciated how the magnitude of warming that he was predicting would affect things like ecosystems or patterns of precipitation or disease vectors, just to name a few things. And in fact, perhaps because he was Swedish, he seems to have basically taken it for granted that a warmer world would be a better world. By the influence of the increasing percentage of carbonic acid, that's what they called CO2 in these days. I should also add that Arrhenius was also an extremely prolific writer and a very popular one. And this is from, I think, his book called Worlds in the Making, which is probably also in this library. By the influence of the increasing percentage of carbonic acid in the atmosphere, we may hope to enjoy ages with more equable and better climates, especially as regards the colder regions of the Earth, he wrote. And secondly, Arrhenius got the timing all wrong. He believed that the oceans would act as a tremendous sponge and they would soak up most of the CO2 that industrialization was producing. And at one point, he predicted that it would take 3,000 years of coal burning to double atmospheric carbon. Now, this up here is a graph that I'm sure many of you will recognize. And on one axis is time, starting in 1958, and on the other axis is CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere in parts per million. And it seems like a very obvious set of measurements to go out and take, but the fact is that until a young chemist named Charles David Keeling, who worked for many years at the Scripps Institution, began to make them in the mid-1950s, precise readings of atmospheric carbon simply did not exist. And in fact, many very eminent scientists believed that there was no such thing as a global CO2 level, because when people went out and took these levels, they tended to get very different readings depending on where they were. And as a result of this basic confusion, most scientists still believed in the mid-1950s, with Arrhenius, that most of the CO2 that we were producing in our factories and in our cars was being absorbed by the oceans. Now, Keeling's measurements are pretty extraordinary for a couple of reasons. What you see with those peaks going up and down there, like the two teeth on a saw, is the Earth, in effect, breathing in and breathing out. And in the summer, when the forests of the Northern Hemisphere put out their leaves and take up CO2 for photosynthesis, the atmospheric concentrations go down. And when those forests go dormant in winter, they rise again. And this is a function simply of the fact that the North has more forests than the South. But meanwhile, on top of that seasonal pattern, you see that very, very clear upward trend. And now ice core records allow us to go back. We can extract the air from ice cores and tell exactly what the CO2 levels were even before we have instrumental readings. And you can see from this slide how far off Arrhenius' prediction was. And we are now on track to double atmospheric CO2 by around the middle of the century, so by around the year 2050. And that is doubled off of what is called pre-industrial levels of around 280 parts per million, so before industrialization, roughly pre-1800. Now, prodded by Keeling's measurements in the early 1970s, a lot of climate modelers began to basically redo Arrhenius' work. And this time, of course, with the help of computers. And meanwhile, other scientists, also becoming interested in this phenomenon, started to look at other things like ice sheet dynamics. And all the way back in 1978, a glaciologist at Ohio State named J.H. Mercer concluded that even a relatively slight warming of the Earth could cause the ice shelves that hold the West Antarctic ice sheet in place to start to disintegrate. And the West Antarctic ice sheet has enough water to raise global sea levels by about 16 feet. And taken together, these findings in the mid-1970s were alarming enough that in 1979, President Jimmy Carter convened the first of what by now are literally dozens of National Academies of Sciences panels on global warming. And this first panel was called the Charney Panel after a distinguished meteorologist who worked here, near here at MIT, named Joel Charney. And the conclusion of the Charney Panel were unequivocal. If carbon dioxide continues to increase, the study group finds no reason to doubt that climate changes will result and no reason to believe that these changes will be negligible. The Charney report further noted that it would be several decades before changes already set in motion became apparent. Quote, we may not be given warning until appreciable climate change is inevitable. Now, at the time that the Charney report was written in 1979, there was actually fairly little empirical evidence to support the notion that the global temperatures were rising. And you may have seen this graph. It's also a very famous graph. It shows how what has happened to temperatures over the last 125 years or so since instrumental records began. And you can see that temperatures went up in the early part of the century, but then they actually dropped in the 50s and 60s. And that's something that we can talk about later if you'd like. And at that point in the 1970s, the leader of the climate modeling group at NASA was and in fact still is, a physicist named James Hansen. And I'm sure many of you have heard about James Hansen because he recently made the front page of the Times by accusing the Bush administration of trying to shut him up. And by 1981, Hansen had gained enough confidence in his climate model, which is called the GIS model, to predict that carbon dioxide warming should emerge from the noise of natural climate variability around the year 2000. And give or take a year or two, that is, as I'm sure you're probably aware, exactly what has happened. Now, these are NASA figures. And as you can see, this chart, you can find it on the NASA website. 2005 was the warmest year on record. And it's closely followed by 1998, which is really, forgive the expression, in a statistical dead heat. And then by 2002, 2003, and 2004. So four of the warmest years on record have occurred just since 2000. And since, as Hansen noted, climate is inherently a noisy phenomenon, it's hard to say exactly when natural variability could be ruled out as the sole cause. But to give you a sense of the scientific community's view on this question, the American Geophysical Union, which is one of the country's largest and most well-respected scientific organizations, decided in 2003 that the matter had been settled. And that year at its annual meeting, it always has an annual meeting in December, it issued a consensus statement which asserted natural influences cannot explain the rapid increase in global near-surface temperatures.
You're listening to a speech given by journalist Elizabeth Colbert, given on April 16, 2006, and sponsored by WGBH in Boston. You can find this and many other fine speeches at forum.wgbh.org. Part 1 of 2.